Welcome to Cambridge Questions. It's the programme that gives the city the chance to discuss the issues that matter with a panel drawn from business, politics and the media. Joining me on the panel this time around, we have Lewis Herbert from Labour. He's the leader of Cambridge City Council and the City Deal Executive Board Chair. Francis Birkett for the Conservatives is South Cambridgeshire District Councillor at Barton, also Vice Chair of the City Deal Executive Board. Bridget Smith is the leader of the Lib Dems on South Cambridgeshire District Council. We have Oscar Gillespie representing the Green Party, elected to Market Ward. Nikki Massey is the chair of CamTru, that's the Association for Cambridge Residents and Traders, formed in the wake of those protests and marches against the City Deal. Finally, Jenny Chapman is the business editor with the Cambridge News. Ladies and gentlemen, your panel. So let's start with our first question, and that comes from Chris Rand.
Thank you, Julian. The negative public response to the City Deal so far suggests to me that it's being led by council officers with limited vision. This is demonstrated by the fact that it's the residents of the area who are coming up with imaginative and acceptable proposals. How can the City Deal leadership be improved?
And what sort of proposals do you have in mind with your question there, Chris?
I'm thinking particularly of the various groups that are around CamCycle, Smarter Cambridge Transport, Rail Future, Cambridge Connect, and perhaps even more importantly, architectural groups, environmental groups and residents associations who really want to improve the living environment and the streetscapes.
Okay, thank you very much. Lewis Herbert.
Thank you, and thank you for your question, Chris. In terms of where we're at, we are where we are with a range of schemes which got cross-party support in 2015 in terms of the early priorities. Some of the schemes are challenging. They involve trying to strike a balance between the needs of communities and the transport routes that are part of the roads and their community. There are obviously views on some of those schemes, and some of the schemes have come out of projects that the County Council had developed before. The City Deal is reviewing its delivery, and we are strengthening the skill base that we've got. We can evidence on Milton Road a very effective dialogue with the community about that particular project, and I'm sure when you hear what comes out of that, you'll reference the fact that the City Deal listens. In terms of the future, the bigger opportunity for the City Deal is the larger sum of money we have post 2020, and so one of the reports that will be coming forward to the December meeting is really, well, how do we make the most of what is an opportunity of a larger sum of money when we have got time to plan ahead for 2020? And I see that as the opportunity to engage with the opportunities of rail, of the imaginative proposal for an underground, £2 billion scheme, not something affordable. But I see tranche two and the dialogue we will have over 2017 about the future direction as the opportunity for a better and a more engaging approach of looking forward. And if we can be bold, we will.
And in terms of the mechanics of the City Deal, who actually were the people who sat down and came up with the ideas that went into the orange leaflet and been disseminated around Cambridge?
The City Deal has always been a number of parties. It was effectively set up because at that stage the coalition had Liberal Democrat influence and it had the funds. The proposals that we can come back to in more detail.
But for the sake of argument, say trees on the Milton Road are wider, forgetting putting aside the separate issue there. But if somebody comes up with an idea, let's have a bus lane to get the traffic into Cambridge faster, where would that have come from? Would that have come from a councillor? Would it have come from a consultant? Who wrote down the ideas which were then put forward?
They are not out of the brains of politicians. They are assessments that are based on evidence about how to make Milton Road work better, particularly when we've got a new Cambridge North Station opening next May. So if you look at the road space on Milton Road, objectively, you'll actually see a lot more space is being given over to cycling. We already have a bus lane, as you'll see if you walk outside of the pub. So it's not as if the City Deal is changing the shape of Milton Road, but it clearly does need to strike the right balance and come up with an environment afterwards that is actually better. If you look at the environment at this end of Milton Road, it's no great shakes. There's not many trees, and it's actually a very broad and unfriendly road.
Nikki Massey, thank you, Lewis.
Well, I think the key question really is the PCCPs. That had most of the people upset.
PCCPs?
The peak time control points.
Okay.
The majority of people, including Camtrue, do not want to see them at all, in any shape or form. The workplace parking levy, that's also been spoken about an awful lot, whether people like it or not. I think everyone agrees we need to do something. What people are upset about, particularly the city deal, is the lack of engagement. Most people didn't even know it was going to happen, the control points. That was supposed to be happening September next year. It was the news, it was the march that Camtrue put together. That made people stand up.
This is a strange thing for somebody who sits in a radio studio on a daily basis and reads out news bulletins. I was reading out headlines that this was going to happen. I'm sure my opposite numbers at the other radio stations were doing so. And people would have had the opportunity to read in the newspaper. So what was it that actually made people wake up to this? Because clearly the information, it may not have been in the right places, but it was around.
I think that was the key. It wasn't in the right places. Not everyone reads the local newspaper, which are no longer free. Not everyone will listen to the radio. It needed to go through letterboxes, and it needed to be in clear English. Even the brochure that came out wasn't quite clear enough. People were reading about it and saying, well, what does that mean to me?
Mm. You started off by referring to the PCCP, where sort of, I guess most people thought it's road closures, even though, you know, people would argue it's not exactly that, but that's what triggered it for people, you think?
To answer your question, of course, many, many residents and Smarter Transport have other options, and there are many other options, and what people have been upset about is that they've not been discussed with the public, and that's why Camtrue formed predominantly, because we felt that we weren't having had our say.
We may come to those transport issues perhaps a little later on in a little bit more detail. Bridget, how does it affect things from a South Cambridgeshire perspective?
I mean, I'd like to return to Chris's original point, which was the city deal being led by officers lacking vision? And I would say yes, absolutely. And that's a big mistake. And that's why, you know, it's actually gone so horribly wrong and has become a public relations car crash that it currently is. I've said all along that the governance was unsatisfactory. It's an enormous amount of power in very few people's hands, three men's hands to be exact. I think things are improving. Now, I sit on the Assembly, which is a body of 15 people which sits underneath the board, and the Assembly is made up of three councillors from each of the three councils involved, plus three representatives from education and three from the business sector. And it's taken the Assembly quite a long time to find its feet, but it's been obvious in the last 3 or 4 months that actually it started working effectively, and most importantly, it started working non-politically, which is what's making it far more effective. So there are good recommendations coming out of the Assembly, and the Assembly is actually serving the purpose well of being the conduit for public opinion, be it public opinion from the local liaison forums, which have been set up, which people are being very, very engaged with, or the numerous residents' associations, which seem to be springing up at the rate of about one a week at the moment in Cambridge City, and also all the pressure groups, which are made up of people with serious amounts of expertise, and they have the vision, which I would argue is lacking in some of the officers who are driving this.
Did you think those people in the residents' associations and pressure groups, people like Nikki and others, yes, do you think that they were brought into the process soon enough? Maybe you feel they've not even been brought into the process now.
We were very, very slow off the mark. So it was only when I was in a meeting complaining that we were missing an opportunity of garnering expertise that was out there. We had the arrogance to assume that we had all the answers when actually there was other people out there with the vision and with suggestions of things that we hadn't brought to the table already. So the City Deal Board agreed for the call for evidence, which I think was a really useful exercise. What a pity it wasn't done at the outset, because that's where it should have been done. When projects like this are successful, it's when you start with the people and what the people want so that they feel, you know, there's some sense of ownership of it. So, yeah, it's all come late in the day, and it means, you know, there's an awful lot of negativity to be put right now.
Oscar Gillespie.
Thank you. Well, the city deal was signed before I became a councillor. There seems to be a lot that's good about it, or a lot that has potential. It's doing a lot to improve cycling facilities. And the event, when it started off, the Hack Cambridge event to brainstorm solutions using innovators and technology people, seemed like a really good idea. But the core issue of congestion doesn't seem to have really been tackled. It doesn't seem to be closer to solving it now than it was at the beginning. It seems a bit like one of those cars that's driven onto the guided busway by accident. The opportunity after the devolution deal, whether the devolution deal goes ahead or not, to start again, to try and bring people back into the centre of the process, seems to be there. I'm not all that convinced by the role of non-elected members on the boards for the city deal as well. People like the university and marshals are influencing the city deal and giving it a sense of security by providing this expert opinion, but it hasn't done that much good so far. One of the key pieces of evidence for the process has been a resident who's pointed out that the PCCPs would have increased air pollution and made people's journeys longer. So if we'd started by looking at people within the city, if we'd chosen consultants who would have taken the best examples of cycling infrastructure elsewhere, instead of bringing really dodgy examples from Oxford, a place which has good cycling uptake because of people's attitude, not because of the good infrastructure.
Not for the first time, dodgy and Oxford in the same sentence. But presumably, though, Oscar, people like you and Francis and our other councillor members on the panel, your job or one of the things you do, you go and knock on people's doors on a Sunday morning or whenever, and there is the opportunity to feedback through the people who are elected. Does it not complicate things if we get people from outside of the local government and the political structure to contribute beyond their initial idea?
I think we need local organisations to be involved as well. We need evidence from experts. I think that should be fed in through officers to briefings for panels made up of councillors to make decisions about, and evidence from residents should be followed up as well, so that if someone's got an idea, it can be explored. We can have exercises of open space meetings, using technology to model the traffic, using artists to help us visualise what it could look like in the future when more technology is available, when different transport modes are available.
OK, thank you very much, Oscar. Let's turn to a fellow member of the press, Jenny.
Well, whenever I hear about provision for cyclists, I think to myself, well, when I moved to Cambridge 2 or 3 years ago, I bought a bike. I have been a cyclist in the past, but I hadn't ridden for a while. And I'm afraid my bike is called Mrs. Pankhurst because she remains chained to the railings, and I think that's where she'll probably stay, because I just don't want to ride my bike in town, not because of traffic problems or anything like that, but simply because I'd rather go in my car. I'm so glad that at last more people are talking about underground tunnelling. I recently visited the AstraZeneca site in the south of the city, and there was this wonderful tunnel which I was told would be wide enough to take a tube train. I'm not suggesting we have tube trains under Cambridge, but for years I've felt that we have to grasp the problem and deal with it substantially by digging under the city, having car parking under the city, and only in this latest issue of the Cambridgeshire Architecture Journal, somebody in there, an expert, has spoken to other experts at Cambridge University, and apparently the substrata is perfect for tunnelling under Cambridge. We always used to be told, of course, that it couldn't be done because it would disturb the college wine cellars, which seemed a very good reason, of course. But I think that that's gone by the by. So I think really tinkering around with cycling, putting out ridiculous things like that counter opposite the Gonville Hotel, all that sort of thing is nonsense. We should save the money and put it all into tunnelling. And the chap in there is also saying if it's electric cars, which it probably will be before long, it won't even need that sort of ventilating that you need for petrol and diesel.
Have to increase the number of charging points from the other 2 or 3 or whatever it is in Queen Anne's car park at the moment. Possibly so. Thank you very much. And finally on this one, Francis Birkett.
Well, I think the problem is so big and the problem is so difficult. And we all want to solve it, as you said. You know, we all want to make Cambridge a wonderful place to live, to work, to study, so that we can travel around, people can get in from the district, people who live here can move around. As you're nodding at me, so I think you agree. And the problem is, it is such a big problem, and plenty of cities around the world, every city is grappling it, including us. That's why I think we need to listen to everybody, and we need to take everybody's ideas on on board. Ultimately, some people have to take a decision, because what's absolutely fascinating, and I see sitting here, is loads of people have got ideas, and they often are different ideas, and they often don't agree with each other. And what we've desperately got to try and do as an entire community is build a consensus.
And how do we do that? Do we ultimately have to put something to the public vote, a local referendum? Happened before. I don't want to get at the Swiss example where they vote for everything, but you could, I guess, arguably, between the councils, organise something to get a representative view.
You could have a referendum. Of course, we just had one for Brexit, but generally in this country, you do it by elected representatives, and that's what councillors are. But you could have a referendum.
To Chris's point, our questioner, of bringing the leadership through, not necessarily individual people, but the direction of travel in order to ensure that the population of Cambridge are absolutely on side.
I think it's absolutely vital that we build a consensus, exactly, and that the leadership listens, the leadership then publishes all the responses, and then sensible, rational, logical decisions are taken that are explained.
Okay, let's broaden this out a little bit. I'll take some views from the floor in a moment, but we've got another question in connection with the city deal, and that comes from Sarah Clark, who I think is right at the back.
In a time of severe cuts to budgets, have the sweeteners in the city deal made it hard for the council to reject it, despite there being clear downsides to some of the conditions? And if so, what can be done to protect the council from this kind of influence?
Lewis Herbert.
The money on the table is 100 million till 2020. And it is true that we have an objective to seek the further funding of the 200 plus 200. So clearly we have to evidence that we've delivered for our communities and also improve transport. So to some extent, and this is similar in the devolution discussion, which the councils are involved in, we are in a subsidiary relationship to government. The funding does have a good opportunity, so we will focus on it. In the current 5 years, we do need to link up housing in places like Camborne, in potential in the future in Waterbeach. We do have to link this up, because effectively underneath the city deal is a three council partnership which is supporting a local plan which we think is right for Cambridge, which doesn't involve a whole load of maverick developments which are currently being proposed on the edge of the city, but which has links up with transport. Now, to actually link up Camborne and further links to North Stow, the links to the 428 settlements, Waterbeach, it does require funding. And we haven't got time to fully exchange over the relative benefits of an underground investment in rail and buses. But for me, the investment in rail and the investment in buses is vital, simply because of the fact that the population is so spread out as soon as you get out of Cambridge, and we have to link these new houses. And to get the local plan through, which we believe is right for Cambridge and South Cambridgeshire, and we've still got to fight that against proposals for what is excessive development around Cambridge, and persuade the inspector during the course of this year and right the way through a chunk of next year, we need to evidence that money is being well spent. I don't think it's a bribe. I think it is an opportunity. We have to justify how well we do.
But do you feel you're being pointed in a certain direction by government to, in some parts, to do things that maybe government should occasionally do, and just absenting their responsibility to the local level?
Well, having worked with Whitehall on a whole range of meetings on devolution, I still reserve my judgment on some of that, because their agenda, particularly with all the pressures of Brexit and other things, is stretched. If government sets rules, sometimes Treasury wants to walk away and not spend any more money. So what we deliver in the first 5 years does determine whether we get further funding.
Oscar, do you think that heads are being turned by these financial sweeteners?
Thanks, Sarah, for the question. To answer it in simpler terms, yes, I think that is happening. I think the city deal is extorting the council to a point where it has to jump through these hoops and take a very linear approach to answering it. And the same thing seems to be happening again with devolution. Ideally, local authorities should be able to make the decisions that they want to, which are best for them.
Do you think that our local councils should simply walk away from this and say, no, we don't want the money, we don't want to have this expansion in Cambridge, we don't need improvements to our transport infrastructure?
I don't think they can walk away in some cases, because the grants that make it viable to solve them other ways are being taken away. So they're being forced through very, very linear routes. And councils will have to engage to some extent in this, unfortunately. You hear people saying sometimes that austerity is over, don't you? But it's absolute rubbish. The grants are being cut so viciously that this seems to be the new model for government, being forced to take quite poor deals just to keep basic services going.
I just wanted to pick up on one of Oscar's points there with you. Do you think that some of the money which has been promised as part of the city deal is money that actually might have come your way anyway in other directions? It's just being repackaged in return for the council's meeting certain conditions?
No, absolutely not. I mean, you have to remember, we asked for this money as a local community. We asked for this money from the government. This goes back 5 or 6 years to, I think it was called the Transport Infrastructure Fund or something like that, when we in this area, and that's all councils, all of us, said to the government, we would like money, please, to invest in local infrastructure. So we asked for the thing in the first place. It hasn't been foisted upon us.
Let's turn to Nikki on this. How do you see it from somebody who's been brought into the process almost through those protests that we mentioned against, well, you call it the PCCO. I'd still prefer road closures. It's much simpler.
Not a road closure, just peak time road closures.
Peak time road closures. Yeah.
Cambridge needs better transport, and it needs money in order to achieve that. And so it's been given money, and the key is about spending it wisely. So do I think that it's a sweetener? Not really. Cambridge is growing fast. More and more people, more and more offices are being built, but there's no infrastructure to support them. And if we're being given money to be able to create that infrastructure, then that's a good thing. The key is it going to be spent wisely?
Bridget, let's end this particular one with you. It's slightly different, isn't it, for South? You know, I can sit in my house in Cambridge and just walk everywhere if I need to. If somebody's in South Cambridgeshire and they're coming along the Barton Road and they're just getting stuck and not moving anywhere, and so how do we square all of that with the financial incentives?
So there are undoubtedly, you know, some conflicts between the needs of the city and the needs of South Cambridgeshire. As you say, we have lost all our bus subsidies in South Cambridgeshire, so very few of us have the choice to take a bus to work or to school. So, you know, we are forced to use our cars. That doesn't mean that we will necessarily bring our cars into Cambridge City. So provide a good park and ride for us. We will leave our cars in the park and ride.
Take away the £1 cost?
And absolutely take away the £1 cost, because actually that's a tax on people in South Cambridgeshire. You know, it is us who suffer as a result of it. There is conflict there. But there's no reason why, if we get it right, South Cambridgeshire can't get their fair share of the deal. It also fails to acknowledge that people in South Cambridgeshire go anywhere other than the city. And of course, you know, lots of us go to Bedfordshire, Hertfordshire.
There's a possibility they go to Haverhill sometimes.
Very likely. So, you know, we have to think about meeting their needs. And of course, rail is often the best way of doing it. But I mean, Sarah's question actually identifies how gross mismanagement of the city deal up till now has made that people feel really, really negatively about it. And that's a tragedy, because there's not another city in Britain that wouldn't give its eye teeth for £500 million of investment in the infrastructure. This is money about driving the economy. And yes, we have been living in very straitened times, and we've got some serious pockets of deprivation, particularly amongst young people, both in the city and in South Cambridgeshire. But by driving jobs, by improving educational standards, by improving apprenticeships, which is one very important part of the city deal, you know, hopefully we improve the lot of people who actually, you know, it's very hard being a poor person in a wealthy area like this. It's harder than being a poor person in a poor place.
It seems appropriate to take a question from Martin Smart next.
Hello, that's me. So I'm a city councillor in Cambridge. I've lived in the centre of Cambridge for 20 plus years. I'm aware of the congestion problems. And as a councillor, I sit on planning committee. So it's kind of a planning related and transport question. Given that the two local plans are proposing 34,000 new homes locally, including 19,000 out of the city in South Cams, what do you think is the best public transport method or combination of methods
to link them to employment sites and to central Cambridge.
Thank you very much, Martin. We also had a related question put forward by Edward Lee, who I think is also a transport campaigner himself, and that was, why is the City Deal not investing Tranche 1 money to build a solid foundation for improving transport along the lines proposed by Smarter Cambridge Transport? I'll start with Oscar on this one.
Well, I thought the presentation about light rail at the Better Transport Cambridge Smarter City Deal briefing, rebooting the City Deal meeting a couple of weeks ago, was very, very good. And it is really hard to take the fact that the City Deal money is a big, big bag of money, not quite enough money to do the solution that seems best. I think a combination of cycling and walking, which has been correctly identified, is right. I think carpooling should be given a bigger role in the solution. And buses have a role, but I think buses have been too emphasised in the proposals we've seen so far.
One of the troubles actually getting people onto the buses in the first place for whatever reason, which may not just be frequency.
They're not publicly run buses, and the idea that they will run in a way that meets people's needs is magical thinking. I think it's like bus ex machina.
let's go the other end of the table to Lewis next. Public transport methods. We've talked a little bit about getting into the city. Are you prepared to maybe even go to central government and say, can we have a bit more money? We want to build an underground system more.
Well, we've seen private investment bring forward the Addenbrooke station far faster than would have happened under Network Rail. So in looking at the future beyond 2020, Julian, I'm very happy to look at these options and compare. With a scheme of effectively an underground in Cambridge, it would have to get funding up front, and it would have to attract sufficient users, not just in the peaks. Now, in terms of the funding up front, if the financial case stacks up, it's quite possible that private sector finance could be part of it. I'm certain that there are options of investing in further rail stations, as Edward Lee has suggested, and Connecting Cambridge have suggested stations like near Fulbourne and Cherry Hinton. Clearly, we're going to improve Waterbeach Station. We've got long-term ambitions for rail for East-West. But I think we just have to also just focus on, well, how do we actually have a more equal relationship with our bus operators in the city? Part of the opportunity through devolution is that that's the only route that we've got where we might be able to have a more of a Transport for London type franchising and equal relationship.
So you wouldn't,
bus fares at the moment,
other bus companies could be in. It wouldn't just be Stagecoach and Whippet. You could have other companies joining in.
Stagecoach have got a very strong position, but under the Transport for London model, there's more of an equal relationship of route allocation. There are going to be improvements next year, including the way the bus operators do ticketing. But for instance, Bridget represents South Cambridge. The bus fares effectively double as soon as you get beyond the city boundary. So one of the issues with Stagecoach, particularly for those communities on the edge, is actually to have a middle tier bus fare rather than going to double fares.
Like the old current London zone system.
So you'd have more of a zone. So I just think if people want to have a look at the buses bill, there are powers for franchising. It's written into the devolution document. One of those powers is to actually give the county-wide arrangement this greater relationship.
Jenny, how do we go about making a case to business? I guess there's two things we need to do. First of all, we need to set up a new bus company, perhaps, or at least convince an existing bus company that it's worthwhile to develop and expand their services, perhaps to South Cambridgeshire, perhaps just around the city. And then we need to convince somebody that it's a good idea to help contribute to a wider transport system into the city. But are there the businesses here who would be able to contribute to that, or some outside party?
Quite possibly, because several years ago, Herman Hauser, I'm sure everyone here knows of Herman Hauser, and he gets lots of business proposals all the time. And I heard that he had at least two a year for matter transfer. So, I mean, bonkers as it is, it's not that far from the Peter Dawes wonderful idea for a roller coaster down Milton Road. So I don't know whether the trees would have survived that, but anyway, I think it's possible that we're going through a transition period where new sort of transport is going to emerge in just the way that cars solved the problem with horses.
Okay. Bridget, how would South Cambridgeshire deal with this?
Well, I mean, I'd just like to go back to Martin's question, which was, you know, what do I think is the best transport method to link people to employment, so people in South Cambridgeshire? Well, because I'm not a transport planner, I don't know. And until there's been a full options appraisal of all the options there, be it trams and trains or bullet buses, which we suddenly heard about out of the blue at the last assembly meeting, we don't know. And this is part of the problem, that some options are being dropped before there's any evidence to drop them. So, you know, and they may be the perfect solution. So, you know, we need the...
But the ideas have to be narrowed down a bit, don't they, to make sure there's actually, you know, well, before you've been wading through goodness knows how many proposals.
Undoubtedly. Unfortunately, a lot of people like Edward Lee are doing a lot of the work for us. But there does seem to be an obsessive focus on busways. And, you know, we have a busway running from St Ives into the city, which went... How many million pounds? Tens of million pounds over budget, which is undoubtedly successful now, but, you know, at a most enormous cost, more than we actually have set aside for the one that's currently being proposed for the route in from Camborne into Cambridge City, which I think is about 148 million at the moment. So, you know, we have to have some kind of comparator there, and we're not being given that. So, we need to know if there is an alternative there. So, you know, it's a constant fight trying to get... evidence for why things are being rejected early on. Congestion charging is a perfect example. That was dropped, I suspect, because it was a political hot potato. It was replaced with the road closures, which was a political hot potato.
Nikki, what would you say the best way to get around the city would be? Is it a system which is already here and needs developing, or is there something new?
I think we do need something new, but at the same time, we need more buses and cheaper buses. Let's face it, people are choosing not to go on the bus because it's so expensive and it's cheaper to get in the car. Well, that should not be.
It's perceived to be cheaper to get in the car, is sometimes the case.
If it's more than one person, it definitely is cheaper to get in the car than it is to get on a bus, and that needs to change. Smarter Cambridge Transport and Edward Lee have many options, light rail, etc., on their website. But from a resident perspective, we do need more buses. We need more buses to go direct to where they need to get to, as opposed to coming through the city centre.
With a public subsidy?
With a public subsidy.
Which puts £50 a year on the council tax?
So be it.
Hmm. Francis, how would you explain that one to your residents?
I think, Martin, your question was how to get lots of people in from the new settlements, the new communities outside Cambridge, sort of 5, 10, 15 miles away, into the centre of Cambridge. The answer, I think, is a combination of bus, rail, light rail, whatever you call it. I mean, without being too flippant, they're all metal boxes with wheels that take 50 people at a time. That's the similarity between a bus, a rail and a light rail. And I think that's the solution. You take 50 people off the road, off the cars and into that. Closer in, you can walk. Closer in, you can cycle. That's why we're very keen on the greenerways, which I think would be a brilliant proposal. But the heart of it from the new communities is going to be some form of metal box that takes 50 people. If you put two next door to each other, that's light rail or rail. One at a time, that's basically a bus. And the point is, you then just have to choose rationally about what you do for each of the new communities. Now, somewhere like Waterbeach, which is on the railway, on Network Rail, you can obviously use that for a railway. Accessing up from Royston and those southern villages on the railway, you can use the railway. But it's just in the real world, I don't think Network Rail is going to build brand new railways into some of our other new communities. You know, we took the decision, or my predecessors took the decision, that Network Rail was not going to build a brand new railway up to Northstow, and therefore the solution was a guided bus for that. Now, if there is a vast demand on that guided bus rail, you could put two or three buses together, and effectively you create a light rail by the back door by evolution. We've taken the view off to Camborne that it's some form of busway, not a Network Rail brand new railway. I think one of the other transport corridors on the 1307 down to Linton or Haverhill or something like that. Now there's an existing old, disused, closed railway. Now that would be quite useful, I think, or quite interesting to see what you would put there. So I think the answer to your question is you just do horses for courses and you choose the logical public transport solution for each new community according to the sort of topography, the settlements, who lives in the way, and choose the right one for the right way.
Right, one more general question on the city deal to wrap with, and that comes from Patrick von Heimendahl.
The city dealers did less than the bare minimum to inform the general public and nothing to inform us business owners directly. Yet for many, the city deal is a direct threat to livelihood. In the last week, some of us received notification that our business rates are up for review. Would the panel, particularly the representatives from the councils, support me in rejecting any expected increase because it simply is not value for money?
And you run a business, I think, Patrick, in the city?
Yes, I do.
Tell us what you do.
I'm the vet in Clarendon Street.
Okay, so thank you very much for that. And let's start with you, Nikki, on this one. You've had a lot of consultation with the various residents and also with the businesses and traders. What's your view?
The city deal, as I said before, people were not aware of the various plans that were going to affect not just residents but traders as well. It came to a great shock to them that come October that they could potentially lose business, or in Patrick's case, obviously as a vet, people wouldn't be able to get to his veterinary service on an emergency basis during peak hours. I think they've got every right to say that their increase in rates is not value for money in that respect. Whole public engagement in the city deal has been poorly executed and it has left a bad taste in lots of people's mouths.
Francis, do you think that the leaflets which were distributed, certainly in the city, and I guess the South Cambridgeshire too, were they distributed fast enough and were they clear enough?
Well, I think they were distributed fast enough and clear enough. It is difficult to reach.
When were they printed? Do you know?
A week after we approved it. I don't know.
So that would have been in
June or July.
June,
or something.
Okay.
Yes.
Took a while to make it into my house.
It probably did, but I think everybody has heard about it. I don't think we can deny that there's anybody on the planet in Cambridge that doesn't know what's going on. I think your question was, I think the question was, should you withhold your business rates because you're upset with the city deal? And the answer is that none of your business rates come to the city deal, so they're separate things.
Bridget?
I don't think anyone in South Cambridgeshire got a leaflet through their letterbox, so you're jolly lucky in the city that you did, because we didn't. We
got, I had two, that might explain it.
Oh, you got ours. So certainly in my community centre in Gamlingay, where I live, there was a pile put on the desk of the community centre, but I think that was as far as it went. So it's an enormous issue to us in South Cambridgeshire, publicising the city deal, and I think most people in South Cambridgeshire haven't got a clue about it. So I have six parish councils and I go and I bang on about it all the time, but it's actually very challenging to engage them because they're struggling to see how it actually affects them, because I have significant peoples in my wards who never come to Cambridge. They don't work here, they're not educated here. So, you know, it's not actually as big an issue to some people in South Cambridgeshire. Having said that, I mean, I do challenge that there hasn't been a lot of consultation, because I think there has been. I think it's failed to reach everybody. And I, as far as businesses are concerned, you know, I do agree it probably should have been far more targeted on businesses. It was very, very late in the day we got a communications officer, you know, employed by the city deal. Very late in the day. I don't know why they didn't start advertising, but it took months, even once they were advertising, to get anyone there. So again, that was all too late. There has been consultation. There's actually, I think, been way more consultation than you get on most things. But, you know, that's all for nothing if it's not reaching the people it's meant to be.
An interesting attempt. You know, Francis rightly makes the point that it's not really a connection with business rates. But there's probably a connection in the heart, isn't there, if you feel that you've been hard done by the people who are now asking you for more cash?
Yeah, undoubtedly. I mean, if you think that whatever the city deal is doing is actually going to impact negatively on your business, you're going to think it's bad value for you. I'm not actually aware. Lewis will probably be able to tell me what the mechanism is with business rates. I thought that sat with central government rather than with local authorities.
Jenny, are there any precedents for this, either in Cambridge or elsewhere, where there's been, you know, successful withholding of business rates or of a particular increase because of some local issue?
That I know of, no. I think it must be terrifying, though, if you've got a business, and then you suddenly are faced with an infrastructure plan which is going to put you out of business. It must be really, really worrying. And I think that there's far too much dithering around, might do this, might do that, which is must be keeping business owners awake at night. It seems to me most unfair.
Lewis, if you had your time over, would you reorganise it slightly different to try and make people like Patrick a bit more willing to part with these business rates?
London and Liverpool are now being allowed to keep their business rates. Cambridge raises £110 million for government. The city keeps £6 million. I think another £10 million goes to the county and to the police. So in terms of business rates, there is a false equation in that the business rates from Cambridge aren't paid back into Cambridge. I mean, I pay tribute to Patrick for his campaigning, because Patrick argued against the peak time road closures very successfully. And we listened. So we listened to businesses. So on the basis of the evidence that I got, I made a statement 3 or 4 weeks ago. I'm the city's representative. In January, there'll be a fresh analysis, an analysis of the responses to the consultation, and we'll come back with another process, and there'll be another opportunity to engage. We take the message that we could improve, particularly our engagement with businesses. We've listened, and we do need to involve businesses in the next stage of coming up with issues.
A couple more questions to go through, but are there any quick points that anybody would like to make which they don't think have been covered on a fairly extensive discussion on the city deal? There's a lady who I can see there, I think.
Oh, good evening. My name's Joanna Gordon-Clark. I think you skipped over rather happily the issue of emissions from cars, saying that scientific advances would no doubt, or electric cars would no doubt solve that problem. But the problem's real now, and along with that is the business of trees. Trees are immensely effective removers of air pollution from cars, and it took threats to Milton Road trees, I think, to bring the residents out in the way that they came out. And I think all that has been slightly avoided tonight. Thank you very much.
Lewis, the lady does make a good double point, really. First, with the emissions coming out of the cars, and of course, what trees can potentially do to ease that.
Starting with emissions, yes, there was a sort of counter-analysis, but on the proposals that did come forward, I'm confident that they would have seriously cut emissions. They're not going forward in their earlier form. We know now that diesels and diesel engines cause a real problem in Cambridge. We know that in a way that wasn't publicly stated 3 or 5 years ago, that the reduction of diesel engines in a city like Cambridge is vital for the health of the city in the future. One of the threads that will be part of our thinking is the relative pollution caused by different vehicles. That is because the country's waking up. It's lost a major court case about not tackling pollution in cities. In terms of trees, it isn't possible to reorient road space without affecting some of the trees. And I know how attached people in Milton Road are to cherry trees and other trees on the road. We have given a clear commitment that there will be an avenue of trees along the whole length of a road like Milton Road, and that isn't the only element that's going to come out of the dialogue that there's been with residents. So,
do you quickly want to come in on that at all, Oscar, and if you have anything from the green perspective?
Yeah, I think the city's tree strategy is good. I would like to see it go further, but I think there was a big opportunity with the suggestion of a congestion charge to make air quality better and to design the charge like London did when it was designing its congestion charge to reduce emissions. The results from the DEFRA consultation over the summer about reducing air quality around the UK is on its way back to councillors. I'm looking forward to a briefing soon, hopefully, about powers that we'll have through that. I'd like to see Cambridge try to be a clean air zone, as Bristol is trying to do. I'd like to see air quality and safety fundamental aims of the city deal, and they don't seem to be treated as those.
Okay, and I'll take one more question if there is one. I don't know where the microphone is. Dom, I'll trust you to position it with the best person you can find.
This question's for Bridget. You described the £1 charge on the park and rides as a tax, is that correct? Surely congestion charging is similarly a tax on residents of South Cambridge?
Yes, it is.
Why is one fair and not the other?
I didn't say that congestion charging was fair. I said it needed to be worked up as an option. We need to know what the impact of congestion charging would be. It was dismissed as an option very, very early on in the process. I personally have my doubts that Cambridge is big enough to sustain congestion charging. The difference with it is that it generates serious amounts of revenue, which none of the other options from the Cambridge Access Study currently do, other than the work-based parking levy, which actually delivers, you know, a fairly small amount of money. The argument that was being put forward at the time was that if there was congestion charging, it would produce sufficient money that it could be used to subsidise the buses in South Cambridgeshire in order to make it fair. And therefore, people in South Cambridgeshire would have the choice to get on a subsidised, affordable bus into Cambridge rather than having to bring their cars. So that was how it would have been made fairer. I'm not convinced either way about congestion charging. I'd like to see more evidence about whether it really does drive what we call modal shift, get people out of their cars onto sustainable modes of transport, and whether it really would generate enough money to match the stick with a carrot.
Thank you very much. I think we better move on, but thanks for your thoughts on the city deal. A couple of non-city deal related questions, and the first of those comes from Colin Rosensteel.
Is a Cambridgeshire and Peterborough mayor worth the £881,000 annual cost?
I noticed, incidentally, that Mark Lloyd, the former chief executive of Cambridgeshire County Council, took a pay cut when he left his job. From £190,000 a year, he got £15,000 less when he went to head up the local government association. I don't know if that helps the question or not. Probably not, I suspect. Bridget, can I start with you on this?
I'm not happy about the mayor. I don't understand why we need a mayor. Why can't the two levels of, you know, highly experienced, embedded local government do what the mayor would do? It's extremely expensive. The office will cost over £1.5 million to set up. It will cost, as Colin said, over £800,000 a year to run. And every 4 years, there will be an election which will cost a further £700,000. And on top of that, it can put up your rates because the mayor has the power to levy the cost of running his office directly onto you, onto your rates. So is it worth it? I don't think it is. I think, you know, we could be doing everything that a mayor is doing in a far more democratic, accountable and transparent manner.
Francis, I guess this kind of almost gets company with another layer of local government, if we're not too careful. Would you support the idea of a mayor?
Yeah, I think a mayor's a good idea. I think it could be a woman. You talked about him, but I think it could be a woman. I don't think he or she is another. I don't think one person can be a layer of local government on their own. I think what we need is some people to go and bash everyone's heads together and try and get a resolution to all of the problems that we got in this area. We've already got a lot of layers of local government. We've already got loads and loads of district councils, county councils, this body, that body. It would be fabulous to have one person who sits at the top, who we can kick out every 4 years if we don't like them, who is absolutely obvious responsible for trying to bash our heads together and get a resolution to the
cost,
many,
which
many
goes with that. It's not just presumably the salary level, it's the office and dare I say the entourage which comes around.
And
it,
I think the cost would be worthwhile if that person, if we elect a good enough person to cut through some of our problems, the cost would be worthwhile.
Jenny Chapman.
Well, I didn't know everyone knows, but the first person to throw his hat in the ring was Peter Dorr, who is the owner of Cambridge TV. And he also the man who suggested the roller coaster along...
I think those ideas could be connected.
Actually, I'm a great fan of Peter Dorr. He's wild and wonderful. He comes up with totally controversial ideas and he just doesn't care. And very often he's right. And because he was the father of internet servers in this country, wasn't he?
Peter Dorr. Pipex, of course, all those years ago.
I'd be very happy to have Peter Dorr in charge because he's such a force.
You know, regardless of it, if it's Peter or if it's somebody else, does it need an independent if were this to go ahead?
I think it would be very difficult to find somebody interested in the job who wasn't allied to one party or another. I don't know which one Peter's allied to, actually. It's probably his own party.
Lewis, you've obviously been working with Francis and with Bridget and with others. Do you need a mayor to help you have those discussions?
When I came to Cambridge in 1990, I was the county's first recycling officer. And at that time, the geography was Cambridgeshire and Peterborough. That's the same geography as the police. It's the same geography as the health service, the same geography as the local enterprise work. There is a reality about that, and if we think about Cambridge 50 years from now, we do want rail connected and we do want other communities around Cambridgeshire to be sharing in the growth. We have almost too much growth in this city, so we really have to plan on that geography. In terms of the deal, yeah, I've been a civil servant in the past. It's not easy with government, but we have to negotiate a better deal. And there's a lot of good in this deal. There's £70 million to build at least 500 council homes. There's £100 million, which I think will build at least 1,500 affordable homes in South Cambridgeshire and beyond. The city deal didn't even have a pound coin for affordable housing. I was the only council leader that opposed the East Anglian devolution. 22 council leaders signed up to that, and we stopped it. I believe this devolution can work. It's not going to be simple. I believe that all of the councils in Cambridgeshire have to work far better
together.
It has
to be devolution with a mayor?
That is the price that the government has set. I hope it is an independent-minded person. I hope it isn't just another local authority suit, that we do get people. Subject to the decisions by the councils in a week's time, I just want to see people come forward who might be interested in this role. I just think we do need to have... given that it's part of the deal, someone who's got the best interests of Cambridgeshire, the whole of the county, including the deprivation that Bridget mentioned earlier. We've got deprivation in this city, but you look at parts of Fenland. The only way that we can really transform parts of Cambridgeshire is better rail links, more housing, more of an integrated economy. And I don't think that's going to happen with seven councils all doing their own thing.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Lewis. We'll have a final question, and that comes from Kelly Green.
My question is to do with Cambridge infrastructure. I see as part of the city deal, there are some sort of broad scope and a good range of things coming forward. I've been really impressed with the extent of the consultation as a business owner in Cambridge and a resident. And I would just like to ask, what do you think are the biggest opportunities from the Chisholm Trail expected to start work later in 2017, including the new badly needed cycle and pedestrian bridge across the Cam?
Chisholm Trail, of course, for those who don't know, is Cam Cycle's proposal for a cycling and walking route which would effectively join the north of the city to the south. I know there's some elements of it which are already in place. I'll go down the line. I'll start off with Lewis.
People knock the city deal, but we've already allocated £15 million to cycling schemes in this city. Francis, when he gets his chance, will be putting a pitch in because we need to extend that out further. The Chisholm Trail will make a big difference. And yes, we already have 40% of people saying that they use their cycles every day, and we need to expand on that. So it will link up the new rail station, it will provide more options. It makes, I think, an issue someone raised earlier about not feeling like wanting to cycle, including because it isn't particularly safe. We do need to have some off-road cycling routes, and we need them to extend into South Cambridgeshire too.
Bridget.
It's a huge relief as an Assembly member that we get to discuss things like the Chisholm Trail, because actually everybody thinks it's absolutely wonderful. And Jim Chisholm is just the most tremendous man, and he's such a pleasure to work with. So I'm delighted with every aspect of it, and it's lovely that we can support some things which we're not going to argue about. However, with my South Cambridgeshire hat on, you know, we want to cycle in South Cambridgeshire as well. So as part of the A428 project, I've been asking that there's a segregated super cycleway which runs from all the new developments at West Camborne, Camborne and Bourne Airfield into the city, or into where a new park and ride should be, so that, you know, we have the choice as well. And I don't just want them linking the villages with the city, I want them linking villages to villages. But there's a lot of business in villages. So, you know, Melbourne has a big business park, Camborne does. We're forced to drive, and it would be lovely if we had the opportunity to cycle.
Okay, Nikki, do you think you'll be having a go at the Chisholm Trail?
Absolutely. As I do cycle, I don't drive. I cycle, I use public transport. So for me, yes, it'll be great to have somewhere safe for the children to go. But also, hopefully it'll encourage more people to cycle. And we will get better, cleaner air in Cambridge. And that's what lots of people are saying that they want. So yes, and hopefully it will shift people out from their cars maybe to go on their bikes. The key is they've got an option.
Francis, what's your thoughts on the Chisholm Trail and linking even as well with South Cambridgeshire?
Well, you ask what would be the great thing about the Chisholm Trail, and I think it would be we can prove to ourselves that we can do it, and then we go and do another one. And that's really the thing. You know, actually, Jim Chisholm has been amazing, but it's taken him a long time to get this far, hasn't it? And we're not there yet. And what we need to do is prove to ourselves that we can actually work together, we can build these really quite long routes, and then, yes, Lewis and Bridget have given me my introduction. The Greenaways project, which I am absolutely passionately keen about, is a network of about a dozen equivalents of the Chisholm Trail, but rather than in the city, spreading out of the city, including to Camborne, etc. And if we can prove that we can do one at the Chisholm Trail, then let's go and do another 12, and that would really make a difference.
And presumably longer than how long, I'm trying to remember how long Jim Chisholm worked on it, 20 years or so? Some considerable time.
He's an old man.
So presumably quicker for that. And Oscar, to end with you, I presume of all of our panellists, you'll be the one who's going to be out the moment that you can go from north to south.
I'll be on there plenty, yeah. Thanks for the question. I think the Chisholm Trail may be dangerous, actually, because it might set a lid on what our expectations are for cycling in the city. It's a wonderful project, but it has to represent a cultural change in cycling, where cyclists are seen as the most effective way to get around short distances. People are treated in a way that keeps them safe. We start getting Dutch-style infrastructure. We start segregating cycle lanes.
Excellent. Well, thank you all very much. Thank you, Oscar, and thank you to all of our panellists today. Lewis Herbert, Francis Birkett, Bridget Smith, Oscar Gillespie, Nikki Massey and Jenny Chapman. And thank you for coming and for being such a good audience. Thanks very much.